Hello, 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 and welcome to a brand new season of the Full English Podcast. And this season is all about cooks that have changed the way that we eat. We're kicking off with Delia Smith. In the UK, Delia has sold some 22 million cookbooks, second only to Jamie Oliver. And she's often credited with teaching the British how to cook, from boiled eggs to Christmas dinner. Joining me in this episode are two writers for The Guardian newspaper, Felicity Cloak, who among her other books has published Completely Perfect, a collection of her brilliant recipes, and Zoe Williams, who writes about almost anything and everything, including her always interesting thoughts on food. As ever, if you like this show, then give it a share and head over to patreon.com/fullenglish to sling us a few quid. Your £3 a month really helps make this show possible. I'm Lewis Bassett. Mixing and sound design is, as ever, from Forest DLG. Zoe, Felicity, welcome to the Full English Podcast.
Thank you.
Felicity, it's your second time here.
Come back for more.
I don't understand why it's not my second time here.
Well, it can be. We'll get there. We're still a new podcast, relatively speaking. Forest DLG is also with us. Who does the music in the show. You might hear a peep out of him. He hasn't got a microphone in front of him, but, you know, chip in if you want to, Dave.
Well, shut up.
Yeah, that works. This is the first episode of a new series, which effectively is all about celebrity chefs. I'm saying it's about cooks who've changed the way that we eat, but effectively that's going to be about celebrities because they're the people that we, have had the greatest influence. Define it how you will, celebrity. But it's also a show about the guests that I'll invite to speak about those cooks. And it's also a show about kind of the way that cooks tell us something about who we are at the time in which they were popular. So great place to start, Delia Smith. She's a huge influence. You know, she's often seen as a national treasure. She's got OBEs and CBEs, and she's a... There's another title that she has, which is like Friend of the Queen.
Rare. Yeah. Like there's only 20 people that have got it or something. Is it like Companion of Honour?
It's something like that. Yeah.
It's something cool, like properly cool, as opposed to those people that just have it on their email sign off. It's a cool thing.
She got to go for dinner with Her Majesty, and I don't know what they ate, but
she was cagey. When I listened to a podcast about it, she was cagey. Like, even that was classified information, which slightly annoyed me. Maybe that just means that they had like fried chicken or something.
Wasn't fried chicken with a queen, surely? Because you can't eat fried chicken with a knife and fork.
No, but maybe with the private companions of honour, they're picking up, they get a bucket, they're picking it up. It's, who knows?
And we'll never know. We'll never know.
We can still know. Delia's still alive.
Delia is still alive. Yeah. She is.
Delia, if you're listening, please just tell me. I won't tell anyone else.
Anyway, she's got the inside track on the monarchy. I don't know what her relationship with is like with the king, but I imagine also pretty good. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Freewheeling.
I'm freewheeling. You know the tart that the king made for his coronation? Did you catch that?
It was like a quiche. I did. What was it? Because I actually made... You make it for Tim. You did a recipe.
Did.
Sorry, this is the editor, the food editor of The Guardian had this dumb idea. And Felicity had to...
It's the kind of hard-hitting journalist I am. I had to rush out that afternoon and make it.
Yeah.
And I had a few issues with it
from scratch. No?
Well, the initial recipe was a little bit hazy, but it was a nice tart.
Yeah.
Quiche, whatever. Yeah. It was good.
Tell us a bit more about what's in it.
It had broad beans in it.
Asparagus, was it?
And had some asparagus, I think, and some mint. And then what was weird about it, which I think they changed in subsequent things, was it had a lard pastry. And I love a lard pastry. It's like really crisp and light, but it just seemed not very inclusive. In a vegetarian tart to put a lard pastry.
Or for Jewish and Muslim friends.
Well, exactly. That's the thing.
But also, it's a little bit confusing to do that in a quiche, right? Because you kind of lose the crunch if it's underneath.
Sides would still be nice and...
Anyway.
Anyway, moving on.
So that to me feels like a real Delia kind of style of cooking.
Yeah.
Right? So I'm throwing out there that, the nexus is still there between the monarchy and Delia.
Oh, we're going deep state. So Delia was behind that quiche.
Delia is deep state. Okay. She's deep cooking. We'll get onto the politics of Delia, actually, because they are one of the most fascinating things about her, I think. And
I
one
think
of the
so
things
too.
That's like kind of under discussed, at least, in the popular commentary around her. Although that might be changing. We'll get onto all of that and a lot more like relevant stuff as well. But I just thought the place to start would just be with you two. Maybe you could tell me how you first came across Delia Smith. What does she mean to you? Who is she in your world?
Delia was basically omnipresent in my childhood because we had the Delia Complete Cookery course where there's a photo of her in a red jumper on the front, sort of looking out with this real 80s hair. And that was always on those kind of annoying cast iron cookbook stands that everyone had in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Sitting on the kitchen worktop. And so she was always there. And I guess, I don't really remember, my mum must have cooked from there, but she was just like the figure. She was the cookbook that we had that was just there. So she was, I don't know, she was almost like just another authority figure to me growing up.
My mum was the most horrible, my mum's still alive, by the way, but never mind. She's the most horrible cook I've ever encountered in my life. She'd put cardamom in everything. She once stewed a rack of lamb and it looked like a hand coming out of the Somme. It was grey and it was scary. It was disgusting. And so she never, Delia wasn't a huge presence in our life. Fuck knows where she was getting her recipes from. They were horrible. Anyway, so I didn't really encounter Delia Smith. I didn't really know the Complete Cookery course years. And I encountered her first as a user when in the early mid-90s when she brought out the four volumes, how to cook an egg, how to do the, you know, those perfect white volumes which taught people from scratch. And it's impossible to overstate how much impact those books had on culture. So what would happen is Adelia would come out and she'd go, "This is the best omelette pan." It was this omelette pan called the Little Gem. And they would leave the shelves and they would be out of stock and that company would be submerged in orders for a year. And then we at the Standard would write a news story about it. And then somebody else at the Standard, me, would do a feature about it and fuck up an omelette and then go, "Oh, well, actually, I didn't mess it up. It's fine. It's great. It's brilliant. Now I've got a Little Gem pan." So it was a huge... She's sort of, you know, she'd kind of come up late 70s, 80s as this very trad young figure, sort of being a bit more modern to the kind of what had come before. And then she had a real renewal, a cultural renewal, if you like, in the 90s.
Exactly.
When she was taking people through step by step and had a massive, massive impact on not just the way we cooked, but the things we knew how to do. Mm. And when you look at kind of scenes to cooking now, people are probably listening, people are kind of millennials, you guys are probably thinking everybody knows how to eat bone marrow, but we really didn't know how to do basic things because it wasn't part of the lexicon. There wasn't any fashionable cook. There was nobody, it wasn't really fashionable to have a dinner party. I remember making a pâté sucré at university and somebody saying, "That's the most sophisticated thing anybody's probably ever done in this kitchen." And I was like, literally just pastry that I put some sugar in. You know, it wasn't normal and it definitely wasn't sceney or hipster. And I don't know. I mean, I'm full of nonsense about this. I'm full of nonsense about kind of trailblazers, but I don't know if like Nigella would have got the same kind of uptake if people hadn't already known what they were doing. If you hadn't already known how to make pasta and how to cook an egg and how to chop parsley and all the rest of it, I don't think she would have had the same kind of instant wall-to-wall
thing. Did you ever cook from Delia?
Oh, yeah, constantly. So in the egg section, I was like, it's really... I mean, it's a little bit patronising because actually I didn't
need
to know...
This is the how to cook...
So just in the first book, there's a really long section on eggs and it was a little bit patronising because I do know how to cook a boiled egg and I did from when I was a kid. But there's a really nice recipe in there for eggs en cocotte with just some kind of mushrooms and some creme fraiche. And I still make it now. Mm. I still make loads of that egg stuff. There's a double-baked Roquefort souffle, which doesn't make any sense, but it's really nice. You know, there's loads of things that I still cook from the Perfect series. And then I ended up just incorporating, you know, like a giant squid incorporating everything.
Felicity, you're known to many people as... in your own right, an influential cook. Lots of people turn to you as, you know, the great synthesizer of all of the stuff that's out there and then you give the perfect version of it. So you must have some experience cooking from Delia, I imagine. And what's that experience been like?
I do. And I actually feel a bit ashamed about it. I think because she was such an omnipresent figure in my childhood. And then, and she wasn't, I was, because I was a greedy child, I did used to read cookbooks, like that cookbook that you bought from the milkman with the pictures of the children's birthday cakes in and stuff. I used to look at that quite a lot. And Delia didn't have any like fun little anecdotes in her books. No. And the pictures were all quite serious. And so I think I rebelled against Delia when people like Jamie and Nigel and all those sort of first name cooks came out and they made it all seem very sexy and fashionable. I sort of cast Delia aside like an old sock. And I think that when I started doing my column in 2010, I think it was, I did try Delia's recipes, but I don't think I was very fair on them. And I was just like, I don't know, I feel bad because one thing about Delia is that her recipes always work and it's not, they may not be to our taste. And a bit like a lot of cooks that are a lot older than Delia, like say Elizabeth David, the seasoning feels very muted to modern palates. I think we've got much more used to very strong flavours these days. And, you know, and people just chucking in handfuls of this and glugs of that. And Delia's very precise and she says, you know, put in 10 peppercorns. You're like, oh, what's going to happen if I put in 11? But, and it's quite easy to mock. But actually, I've since realised that it's, you know, to have someone whose recipes always work and the fact that now looking back on it, she was a real trailblazer. I feel really ashamed of the way that I was quite dismissive of Delia in the early days. And Delia, I'm really sorry. Well, I just feel like, you know, she was someone that was so familiar and I wanted the exciting, sort of more glamorous people. And actually, sorry, Delia.
She's a victim. It's a confessional. Kind of, what you were saying, Zoe, she's kind of a victim of her own success. Like she led the way for the Nigellas, for the Jamies. Yeah, I mean, Jamie Oliver would admit this, I think. I've seen him say that kind of thing. Like that if it wasn't for her teaching people the kind of basics, setting up, and also in her like summer cooking series, that was pretty path breaking itself.
I know, but the whole, the seasonal ones I went back to after I discovered the perfect ones. What I think she's good for as well is A, cooking, like it became incredibly unfashionable to say you didn't want to get fat. And it's still really unfashionable. You would never, you just wouldn't find a kind of mainstream cook saying that because it would be fat shaming. But, you know, sometimes you don't want to eat everything in the house. Sometimes you do want something that's just like, and Delia is quite good for that. So I remember this when I was like, on the Standard and just, you know, like living like a lord, I used to fall back on that haddock and spinach and chive recipe. And it was just so perfect and so easy and so not gonna just like capsize you for 2 days. It was really, really, really good, but she never gets credit for any of that because it's not very fashionable to say it. She also never gets credit for the kind of basics. Like I still go back to her for Yorkshire puddings, although I would say she's got, I mean, this kind of relates to my previous point. She's got a problem with portions, I think, because there's a recipe she's got that's Yorkshire pudding for six, and my son ate, no, toad in the hole for six. My son ate it on his own. And okay, he's a teenage boy, but it was mental. It was like, and the other thing is that she's really, really good on quite trad cakes. So if you look at someone like, I'm just thinking of the Guardian stable now. You know, everybody's sweet tooth in the Guardian. You can look at, there are cakes in there, which are like 1.25 kilos of sugar in a cake, in a single cake. That is mental to me. Whereas Delia's cakes are really, when my dad was dying, I think I went through every single one because he had got a really sweet tooth. And it was like the winter fruits one is really good. The chocolate and walnut is really good. The Victoria sponge is perfect. The lemon with lemon curd is perfect. There's a really nice coconut one. This is all just from the Cookery Essential one before you even get to the cake books. I mean, she's like very, very, very accomplished at classic English cooking, going through a kind of much more of a Jane Grigson history than a silver spoon history. Am I mangling that?
No, and I think that's quite something that's very significant about her cooking is that I think one of the reasons that she's become quite unfashionable is she represents that sort of plainness that it's very fashionable to say, oh, British food was terrible because it was so plain. And actually there's a real subtlety to a lot of those dishes that is not acknowledged. And it's not that those cakes are boring. You just have to work harder than something that has got loads of buttercream and like seven layers and et cetera, et cetera. But they're really good, relatively plain cooking. And I just don't think we don't value that enough because it's not, you know, it doesn't look that great on Instagram.
Yeah, it's
not showy. And actually, there was an interesting quote that Delia gave in, I think, one of her Desert Island Discs or something that I was listening to. And she said that she'd stopped writing recipes because basically they'd all been done and, you know, everyone was just like recycling
fault,
the whole thing. And I was like, it's such a brave thing to say because, you know, the recipes in The Guardian, for the most part, are just you're desperately trying to put your own spin on something. Mm. But someone else has done them. So, you know, you might put, you get Delia's, coffee and walnut or whatever it is. And then you go, oh, maybe I'll put some cardamom in there to jazz it up. It doesn't need it. And so I just thought it's a real brave thing to say. So we don't need any more recipes.
She has a kind of an aversion to anything that she sees as, quote, poncy, which actually isn't, she's not the first person to have that view. Like Elizabeth David had the same view. They actually use the same term, like theatre on a plate. They hate that kind of stuff. And then she also has an aversion. She says she doesn't even read cookery books anymore. I listened to an interview recently, her saying, because she doesn't know what half the ingredients are. And I was like, come on, Delia, you do. Like, if it says Szechuan peppercorn, you're probably going to know what that is, right? But she's, I guess she's just kind of been there, done that, you know, made you the T-shirt, told you how to, you know.
Told you how to wash the T-shirt. The thing is with Delia as well is
she's moved on to spiritualism, as I say, we'll come to that. But yeah.
She's got this, she has actually got a kind of aversion to a lot of things. Like she hates ponciness, theatre on a plate. She doesn't like people like sticking their fingers in their mouth and being messy. So that's like,
one of the things she never ever eats on screen. You ever notice that?
Yeah, and good. Sorry.
Yeah, she hates all this kind of like all of that. She absolutely hates it. It's amazing she hasn't made more enemies, to be honest, because because a lot of other people do exactly the things Delia hates, and she manages to say she hates them without those people not liking her.
Yeah, because she does come across as quite sort of stern and schoolmarmish, particularly in her early sort of oeuvre, if you look back on the clips that are online. But I was actually, I have met her and I was quite scared of her. And actually she was just like a nice, funny person. Mm. I was like, what was I expecting here? A monster? But she was, you know, I think it's just the style of the time. And also I really feel quite strongly, because you might say, oh, Keith Floyd, he was very easy on screen and very jokey. But I think a gender thing and a class thing, Keith Floyd was able to do that. The two fat ladies were able to eccentric and free and easy, whereas Delia sort of came from a lower middle class background and, you know, had to work harder and had really, the story of how she got to be where she is extraordinary. She got no O-levels, nothing. Left school without a qualification, never done any cookery courses, anything.
That is quite weird. I mean, just from the kind of precision of her, I'm surprised that she didn't try and get O-levels.
I think she just failed them all. It's like...
This show obviously isn't about, as you would have already guessed if you've been paying attention, isn't really going to give you a good, deep biography of Delia. you can get that from listening to Desert Island Discs. There's a great podcaster, the food show on the BBC, also kind of delve into Delia's biography. But as a quick overview, so she was born in Surrey. That's why she has the accent she has. But yeah, like you said, kind of lower middle class.
Basingstoke. I'm certainly not throwing any shade on Basingstoke, but when I see Surrey, I see sort of like millionaires' mansions. Basingstoke having that many.
Exactly. And then so her dad was in the RAF, her mum was a housewife. This is the kind of basic précis. She left school without any O-levels and attempted to become a secretary, failed at that, then became a hairdresser, found it, I think, completely tedious and boring. Although she did have a little stint of doing that.
She quite enjoyed it, but she was rubbish at it. Which made me laugh.
Something I listened to that she just said she just couldn't pay any attention. I think if she was a child today, at the same age today, she would say that she had ADHD, right? She just couldn't focus on anything. And then it wasn't until she just started to like become interested in food. And I think she said she had a boyfriend who took her to a French restaurant. She became really obsessed with the food there, asking the cook, like, how do you make a salad dressing? And then writing it down meticulously. And then ended up washing up at this French restaurant on a Saturday night and then starting to cook some of the dishes. She went from what she described as a washer to a chopper. And then spent a lot of time hanging out in the British Library reading old 18th century English cookbooks. because she had this, a bit like, again, Elizabeth David's trajectory, she had this reaction as to French food, like, why are we spending so much time cooking French food? What happened to all the English food? Wanted to get this book published that was about 18th century French cooking. No one wanted to pick it up. And then it wasn't until she got a column in the Mirror in 1969, published her first article there, that from then on kind of led to her becoming increasingly involved in writing cookbooks and appearing on TV. And as you said, Zoe, she had a really, she was on people's screens in the 70s, but it was in the 90s that I think she really kicked off. And I think there must be something particular about the 90s, because that's kind of where there's a lot of celebrity chefs happening in that time.
I was thinking about this with regards to something completely different today, but there was that weird thing in the 90s. And I think when people call it, when people on the left call it the long 90s, they're talking about this, which is that the all the kind of oppositionalism between kind of the establishment and not the establishment, between the mainstream and the counterculture, between things, you know, things staying the same and things changing, it all kind of collapsed. And whereas in the 80s, you never would have got a 24-year-old saying, "I'm staying in to watch Delia." In the 90s, that would be like an ironic statement. And the idea that you could do a not cool thing and then be cooler for having done the not cool thing was sort of like taking hold. And in the fullness of time, I think part of that was a mistake, but I think it was good that so many people watched Delia. Sorry, by the way, listeners, if you can hear a Darth Vader noise, it's me vaping. I just don't want them to have to edit out everything I'm vaping over.
Yeah, we are also eating Delia's first ever recipe that she, that as I mentioned, she published less the noise.
It's an electric toothbrush.
Why? Yeah, it's a strange vape noise. You don't.
Actually, it's because the aperture is open too wide. Sorry, everybody. Okay.
I had no idea vapes had aperture. Mm. You know about
this? Yeah. Look, that was better, right? That was way better. You hardly heard that.
We're also eating Delia Smith's first ever published recipe, which is kippa pate, published in 1969 in the Mirror. Oh, by the way, she ended up marrying the editor of the Mirror at the time, or her editor at the Mirror. As an aside, what do you guys think of this pate? I've followed the instructions as best I could.
That's like a pre-defeat statement. I did my best.
No, I mean, I think it's nice.
I think it's delicious. I think it works really well. And it's very Delia in that even I, who am quite a simple cook, would have been tempted to put something else in there. But I think it's literally just like kippers. Spring onions, what else is in there?
Butter. Cayenne and lemon and and butter.
Yeah, she's not gone, oh, what this really needs is, say, some Sichuan peppercorns or chives or whatever.
This is 1969, right?
Do you remember her?
Spring onions probably quite like exotic.
Actually, you're probably...
Yeah. Well, now, cayenne's pretty old school.
It is pretty old school. But you're probably all too young to remember the smoked mackerel pate. She was like the first person to say
that's where my mum got it from.
Yeah.
She was obsessed.
She was like the first person to say that's an okay thing to serve at a drinks party. Because it's like the whole form before that was that you had to make these stupid vol-au-vents. But vol-au-vents is really hard. Vol-au-vents is hard. And then she kind of came out and was like, no, you can actually just do a pate on a piece of toast. And I think it was quite revolutionary for people in the generation above mine who previously would have experienced that as a kind of terrible social anxiety and suddenly were like, well, no, anybody can whiz up mackerel, horseradish.
As a chef, she feels incredibly democratic. Like, I mean, and what I mean by that is, though, although she seems to come across with her, to me, like kind of, you know, Southern Surrey accent, knowing, however, that she's not from a rich background, it's like if you asked who is it that she's cooking for, it's like, who's the BBC for? It's kind of like for everyone.
Yeah.
And like she has made it her like life's work to teach everyone in Britain how to cook. And you mentioned earlier that some people find that patronising, but other people, I think, have really benefited.
But also, there was a real moment in the 90s when Nigella was kind of massive. And it was not unusual to go to two dinner parties, because dinner parties were also massive, to go to two dinner parties on a Friday and Saturday and be fed the venison stew recipe at both of them. Mm. It was like very much a kind of badge of identity, making a Nigella recipe. I love Nigella, by the way. Whereas nobody would ever try and build a... an identity out of Delia. They were like, you know, it was just, it was just, you made a thing and it was nice. It wasn't like, oh, I've got the new Delia. And that again was that part of kind of collapsing the cool with the not cool and the identity with the not identity, all that kind of collapsing. What are you trying to build with yourself? Delia kind of came in the middle of, and everybody was like, I'm not trying to build anything with this food. I just want to eat it and for it to be tasty.
I think, again, that's like a bit like Elizabeth David. There's a kind of authenticity about her. That, like, she, I mean, Elizabeth David, I think, was obsessed with authenticity, like going to the place that, like, you had to eat tomatoes in Naples, otherwise it wasn't a tomato kind of thing. Delia Smith is the thing. She's like, we're in Britain, we're going to eat a boiled egg and some kippa pate.
She also wasn't massive on ingredients. Well, you must know way more than me on this, because...
Yeah, I mean, she does. You can find her being asked about it, and you get the sense that she cares quite a lot about the ingredients, particularly like local producers to her and relationships like that. But she's not one of those people. There was a time with recipes where you couldn't just write two eggs. It had to be two free range, you know, it's really ramming the politics down people's throats. And I don't think Delia ever went down that. She's very inclusive in the sense that her instructions are very foolproof and she's not pricing anyone out of the market. She's kind of, I don't know, she's humble isn't the right word, but quite self-effacing. Like, you don't, as you were saying, that no one's going to build their identity around Delia. She never seemed to me to be interested in being sort of a big brand. She just wanted to teach people how to cook and, you know, make a living herself. But it wasn't like, I want to take over the world with my style of cooking. She didn't think she was reinventing the wheel.
Do you remember that story when the internet first happened? When the internet first happened, somebody said you should have a website called Delia. And she looked for a website called Delia, and it was already owned by a dry cleaners in America. And she could have bought it off them, but she thought, a principle of fairness, they're already called Delia. So that's why she's Delia online.
No way. That's a great little anecdote. I mean, yeah, so she's, I mean, her vibe is definitely, it's not pretentious. She's not like, yeah, throwing things around that don't need to be there. And she's just, yeah, doing kind of humble everyday cooking, I guess. And yet it clearly worked. Like I said at the start, like, she sold more cookbooks than any other cook in the UK other than Jamie Oliver. And you mentioned this thing that people refer to as the Delia effect, which the example of it is that frying pan, the omelette pan, which I looked into, and apparently it was called a Loon metal pan. And they were making 200 of them a year. And then after she featured them, they were getting orders for like 200,000 a year.
I think you still get them?
Yeah. They're amazing.
They actually are.
Yeah.
I don't know. Really
good. I've got the big one and the small one, but I didn't buy the big one until I got married. The first time. Because you only need a small one.
But she also did
more.
The cranberries, which I thought had been Nigella.
Yeah.
But I remember that being a news story. Was that in the mid-90s? Like, suddenly she recommended using cranberries. Because I feel like before that, you just bought a jar of cranberry sauce. Like, that was what you did. Whereas Delia was like, making it, that's pretty fancy, but she caused a real rush on them.
But I think you're right. I think it was half Delia and half Nigella, because Nigella had that amazing Bakewell tart that she made with cranberries, and it's so beautiful, it's insane. But she wouldn't have been able to, again, I don't think she would have really been able to do that if Delia hadn't already said, don't be afraid of cranberries, just because they look super hard, you just have to make them hot, then they go soft.
We've come to a thing that I wasn't expecting to touch on as much as we are, which is that how popular Delia was in the 90s when it was a crowded market for celebrity chefs. And like, when I think of Delia Smith, I think of her a bit younger in the 70s with the bob, like in a set that's been made to look like a kind of 70s housewife's home, with like really dour colours, like greys and beige and stuff. And she's basically teaching you like how to make like, yeah, Yorkshire pudding for one person or something. But actually, yeah, she peaked in the 90s. And I just like, what? Again, I mean, you've said already, but like, I don't know what that says about people, that they were flocking to Delia at that time. Like, they were looking for something comforting, something reassuring, something, I don't know.
I think you're just overestimating you're underestimating how little skill, how much skill you guys have. We just didn't know what we were doing, you know? It's like, if you came out of a kind of 70s, 80s childhood, the middle class thing was for your mother not to cook. The middle class thing was for your mother to go, I've got a career. Screw you. and eat Finder's crispy pancakes. It was not, you didn't come out of that childhood with a kind of, Nigella was really unusual in having grown up around a mother who transmitted love through chicken tagliatelle. Most of us grew up around a mother who transmitted love some other means and ate crap. So it was a kind of reskilling. I think she reskilled the generation at the same time as kind of hitting that postmodern thing where you're no longer trying to be cool. You're trying to be uncool and cool at the same time. And she was kind of defiantly uncool.
I see her as a kind of stepping stone to Jamie and Nigella and Ottolenghi and other people that we're going to talk about in this series. But it wasn't so much like chronological. It was all happening at the same time.
Because Nigella's How to Eat came out in, was it 1998?
But the glory year for Nigella was 2003 with Domestic Goddess.
But then I don't know when Jamie Oliver's first book came out. I remember Nigel Slater popping up at my parents' house, not literally, sadly, but on their coffee table. Someone cool must have given them the book, but in like maybe 2000.
Well,
most of the 90s, there weren't these celebrity chefs, were there?
Funnily enough,
they were like French people.
We did the first interview with Jamie Oliver in 2000 because he did actually come to my flat. And he came on his little moped. It was promo for Naked Chef. So he came on his little moped and he kind of came in and he was like, is it going to get nicked out there? And I was like, screw you, weirdo. it was in Camberwell. My sister was around. He brought ingredients for two for me and him to eat because it was meant to have a kind of romance thing. My sister wouldn't leave because she did actually romantically like him. So he had to split everything in three that he'd made really carefully for two and then cook in my house. And it was he was way more radical than Delia. You know, he made mostarda di frutta. What's that thing where you put dried fruit on pasta? That's right?
Mostarda di frutta is that sort of preserve.
Mustard fruit. So he put those on ravioli.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly. Bonkers. My sister hates fruit in savoury food, but obviously it was Jamie Oliver.
But that's interesting because that is not something that is his style now. He's a talented cook, but he wouldn't be scaring the horses like that. But he'd just come out of the River Cafe.
Yeah.
And
he was trying to differentiate. He was just like, blah.
So, Delia wouldn't do that.
So
not
Naked
in
Chef,
a million years.
Naked Chef aired and the book came out in 1999, according to that their internet that was invented recently. Delia was getting big in the midnight. So it was chronological, but it was all quite compressed. Yeah. So we had a kind of moment where I guess your generation, as you're saying, their parents were feeding them baked beans. And Delia was like, here's how you make an egg. Yeah. And Jamie was like, here's how you make an egg, but you put rocket and mustard fruits with it. You're listening to The Full English Podcast. If you like the show, give it a share. And to help make this show possible, go to patreon.com/fullenglish. Thank you for listening. Do you think that she has a kind of conservative attitude? Because we talked a little bit about how she doesn't like poncy food and theatre on a plate, and she doesn't feel comfortable with reading modern cookbooks. But or is it that she is just, you know, belongs to this time that she was teaching people to cook kind of, you know, the essential? Mm.
I think that I and probably other people are guilty of assuming a conservatism because of the style of recipes that she was writing, which was teaching people how to cook and being extremely precise. And because her palate, I don't think she's the kind of woman that, say, puts Rwandan chili oil on everything, or, you know, I think she's probably quite restrained and probably has nice, neat portions of things, etc. But I don't know actually whether she is conservative in the sense that she was making hummus in the 70s. Yeah, yeah, and, you know, I just don't think I discovered hummus until, I don't know, I was about 20.
She's got quite an old-fashioned sensibility. So she said on one of her TV shows, I always have capers in my larder. And a gentleman wrote in and said, what kind of capers do you have in your larder? And she found it so hilarious that she was... I think she might have put it in two books.
Right.
Like this kind of saucy little remark. So I think she's quite... There's an old-fashionedness which is possible to mistake for conservatism, and there is also kind of quite a high disgust quotient, you know, which you kind of associate with being right-wing. Like, I don't want a stain on my tablecloth. I don't want people sticking their fingers in their mouths. I don't want to eat on screen. There's a lot of disgust. But that association between being right-wing and being disgusted is quite loose, you know. It's quite kind of, it's quite a kind of epidemiological population level thing. It doesn't actually mean she's conservative.
Yeah.
She's also, though, you know, got this kind of model housewife thing going on.
Yes.
And the Surrey accent, again, we know.
And
you know,
the hair. I think, right? When I think of that 80s or 70s hair, like the big, like slightly Princess Di, but...
Yeah,
Delia.
But then the complicated thing is, as you said, like she was teaching people to make hummus long before. And there's a clip in which Delia is, I think, in one of her early TV shows, so in the 70s, goes and meets Kate Bush, who is seemingly the only vegetarian she knows at the time. Kate Bush is, I think she introduces it in this really funny way. It's like, well, people say that vegetarians and never be healthy and strong, but Kate Bush is healthy and strong. And what does she eat? And what she eats is like a bunch of salad and like...
That she hasn't cooked herself either.
Yeah, her sister made her, that's it. And then this kind of really sad looking like lentil meatloaf thing.
And
I'm sure at the time, and to our eyes, that looks really not that appetizing personally, I think. But at the time, I think that was probably quite radical, right?
Mm.
And so she's been kind of like, she seemed to be in the 70s quite kind of a champion of like the whole foods movement, like eating food that wasn't necessarily manufactured, you know, like she was kind of promoting, you're disagreeing with this. She was into like brown bread and stuff.
I'm thinking about the disgusting food there was around. Do you remember Cranks? There's no way nobody remembers this.
I know Cranks. I know, because I was brought up a vegetarian.
Oh,
I know Cranks. We had
okay.
the Cranks cookbook at home.
So. So the Cranks, the Cranks cookbook is like literally disgusting. It's like, you know, but like squish mushrooms into a brick and then just shove them in your mouth and they're disgusting. And I think she was really suspicious of that.
Yeah.
And she was, in a way, trying to do what she was trying to do with eggs for the broader population, kind of say, it doesn't have to be like that. It doesn't have to be Cranks. It doesn't have to be kind of... Because there was almost like a self-flagellation element to vegetarianism, not just in the 70s, but right back to kind of when George Orwell said the problem with socialists is that so many of them are vegetarians. There was this kind of sense that you were doing it in order to perform your self-abnegation for the rest of society. It was a Calvinist thing.
Mm.
And so she was kind of trying to draw vegetables back into normal. And I don't think she was always successful at the start. I mean, some of the veggie stuff was actually a bit rubbish.
No, I don't think she was always successful. I just think it's kind of cool that she was championing.
Yeah.
I think it comes back to what you were saying before. Like, you were a generation brought up by your parents on Finless Crispy Pancakes. And she was saying, you know what, like, you don't have to take the whole... Because she said recently some pretty, like, negative things about vegans. She's not a big fan of vegans. But she, at the time, seemed to have a lot of time for vegetarians. And especially, I think, because of the kind of whole foods element.
Yeah.
And that kind of move away from... I don't think she would do that now, because that's very too... Kind of almost like too on trend for her to do now. But, like, at the time, it was like... Yeah, I don't know. It seemed like just a kind of... I guess part of her general project of educating the British people how to eat and cook kind of in a slightly reasonable way.
But I think it slightly speaks to her limitations that, you know, she would conceive of how good a lentil could taste and then that would be the end.
Right.
That was the end of the road for the lentil. Whereas I think if you look at what Felicity does, then you know, it's like a much broader vista. It's like if this, you know, I really think that. I think your vegetarian kind of comprehension is so huge that it kind of, that there's no limit to how nice a thing's going to taste.
Mm. Yeah, but I suppose, again, that's having grown up. I mean, she didn't go abroad until she was like 20
yeah,
or something.
Sure.
It's just, I would be really interested to know how she made that jump to being so interested in food and getting all of that sort of knowledge and experience, because her books, even though they do focus largely on sort of British classics, there's all that one that people always go on about, like the Piemontese peppers seems to be one of her real classics that people always mention. She's basically like, I think, a stuffed pepper with pesto. I mean, delicious, but I don't know. She's just a bit more.
Yeah.
I think that she's probably quite I want to say for her age, but I guess she's like my parents' age. She's not ancient, but.
So the other great passion of her life is football. And so in 1997, she bought a majority share in Norwich City Club. And there's something about that I find that also kind of relates again to some of the things we've been saying, which is that although she does seem like, you know, a companion of the Queen, that's what it's called, companion of honour.
You did get that right. I didn't have a clue.
Although she feels, yeah, again, a little bit, you know, housewife, a little bit, you know, stiff lip and, you know, companion of the Queen. You know, this her deep love for Norwich City Football Club, again, just makes her just the real, you know, person of the people, you know? Like, there was that moment that everyone will remember where she said, what was the thing?
Let's be Avenue.
Yeah.
So good.
It became, like, viral. And it's just like, I know some people are obviously like kind of hating her for that, but it was just so in touch, I think, with how people.
It was so raw. And actually, I think that people really commented on it and were shocked by it. Not because it was anything amazing, that I'm not a football fan, but I'm assuming it's not that unheard of for an owner to do that. But the fact that it was Delia letting go, and there's like this like guttural roar comes from her. Yeah. And that it was just such at odds with her sort of very constrained, conservative public personality that. I think people loved it. I mean,
that's
I
very liked true.
I think he's dangling free.
Let's be Avenue.
Yeah.
I think it's more Cockney, isn't it? Yeah.
Let's be Avenue with an AV.
Let's be Avenue. Let's be Avenue. Let's be Avenue. Yeah, it's Cockney, definitely.
It's legendary. It was great.
Yeah. I mean, there's a thing, isn't there, as well, that football is such a it's such a mediating idea for people who aren't of the people to pretend they're of the people, because it's the taxonomy of it is so simple. I support this team. I can look up what happened to them. I can pretend to be happy. It's just such a simple way in that you can fake it, except you actually can't, because when politicians do it, they're found out immediately.
You couldn't imagine Rishi Sunak kind of sitting in a terrace.
No. But if you think about David Cameron getting his team wrong and Gordon Brown pretending he went to football and everybody being able to see that he's never been to football. Yeah. It's like politicians think they can fake it, and then you see Delia not faking it, and you're like, that's what it looks like when you don't fake it.
She's authentic. This is the thing. Yeah, I think she's really authentic.
She's the first talking about football.
Yeah.
Now she does, definitely. Now she prefers talking about spirituality.
Oh, yeah, no, tell us about spirituality. Come on to this? Yeah, come on to this, because I don't really know what...
Spirituality.
It's not me.
Well, I read some of her book, which it's deep. It's really deep. The book is called You Matter, and I understand that she tried to put it through a bunch of publishers with her agent that she's had for like 50 years. All of them turned it down, and she got this kind of publisher that I don't remember the name of. So it's really hard to get published. And it's basically a book that's quite hard to pin down, but it's about... So she's been writing books about religion since the 80s. No one's been reading them, about her kind of like Catholic beliefs and stuff. There's like books of prayer, but this one, it's not a religious book, and it's not really a book about... it's kind of a book about meditation, but she hates using the term meditation. And it's just quite vague, but it's about like human flourishing and people realizing through, I guess it's about people understanding themselves so deeply. It's quite hard to summarize. It's like, it's not like a cookbook.
You're doing great.
Thanks. It's kind of about people understanding themselves so deeply that they can let go of their own ego, and through letting go of their own ego can therefore be part of a better form of collective humanity.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, it's cute. It's kind of, buddhist-y.
Yeah, it's kind of Corbyn.
It's kind of, but I don't imagine she's a massive Corbyn fan. I'm throwing that out there.
No, because, one of the other intriguing things about Delia was, do you remember in the Brexit times when she was out on those marches with
which side was she on?
Oh, she was really anti-Brexit. Like, she was properly got the t-shirts and everything, and had a really grand picture of herself having lunch, I think, before a march at somewhere like the Savoy. And I just loved that for her. Just like,
yeah, that is cool.
Delia, don't be
So her being a person of the people has limits.
She has not come out against the will of the people since, I believe. But, but so, yeah, Corbyn, maybe
she,
not Corbyn.
She, one of the things that comes across in this book is she just hates demagogues, but she also hates politicians. So she talks about how, like, populism is going to be something that's going to be consigned to the dustbin of history along with fascism, Marxism, and all these other things. And we're going to have this kind of, like, human realization. The more we get to know each other, know ourselves and know each other, and like this, she really believes in, like, popular assembly. She's like a radical Democrat. Mm. She doesn't really believe in Westminster, which in a way kind of makes her a populist, but she really doesn't like leadership and like demagogic leadership. It's an interesting book that I read you a fun quote from it. So she writes, "After many years of reflection, I'm certain that if enough of us are willing to explore the deeper inner dimensions in our own lives and the world, then a new dynamic spiritual energy can emerge. Just as the universe is reflected in a flower, it is also reflected in you." That's the Elizabeth, wow. Guys.
Oh, that makes me feel so warm.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's vague and a bit, like, it's obviously incredibly utopian. And but
trippy. I like that.
Yeah, but she just kind of wants everyone to achieve the best in life. She wants human flourishing.
Isn't this just, like, the consequence of being a celebrity trying to get involved in... Politics is really boring to get involved in, right? It takes, the problem with socialism, it takes a lot of evenings. You have to listen to people. You have to hang out with people you don't necessarily like. It takes, like, to get to kind of a place of political activism, you need to really put the work in. And then normal people have their views, but they don't necessarily write them in a book.
Mm.
But then celebrities go in at a very high level. There's no entry level for a celebrity.
So she wrote the book You Matter in lockdown in the shed at the end of her garden, which kind of think reads like she has this practice of every day. She doesn't call it meditation; she just calls it whatever. I don't know what she calls it. Of just like sitting still for an hour without talking to anyone. Just she sets a time and she just sits there and doesn't. This is Delia Smith. That doesn't feel very like.
Nah.
Companion of the Queen.
No, it doesn't. It does sound a lot like meditation. Mm. No offense, Delia.
But it's cool. She's
big because on her Desert Island Discs in 1982, her first track was The Sound of Silence, and she is obsessed with like...
And the Beatles she has in there as well, one of the kind of hippier like, tracks from
exactly,
the Beatles.
Exactly, one of the kind of hippie trail, like Ravi Shankar.
She's got a John Lennon energy, basically, but she's smuggling in John Lennon energy through looking and appearing like the Queen.
She's a very surprising person, and I feel very naive for not having realised that earlier. And
well, I mean, let's come to some sort of summing up.
It's summing up time.
I'm just concerned. I'm having a great time. I'm just concerned about people listening to this.
I'm just concerned for the listener.
No, I mean, I want to start with the summing up. It's just like, who do you think that she was inspired by and who do you think she has helped to like lead the way for? We've talked a bit about that, but maybe we can say a bit more on it.
I'm deferring to Felicity first because... She just knows more shit than I do.
I mean, she's talked a lot about being inspired by her mum, who actually died quite recently and I think was a good cook. But I don't know, she doesn't often mention, I don't know whether she was, I don't get the sense that she would have hung around with people like Elizabeth David. Elizabeth David was, I think, quite snotty and I don't think would have thought Delia was a bit sort of infradig. So I don't know about her other influences, apart from being in London in the swinging 60s and eating out and etc. And I think she's basically inspired almost everyone that grew up in Britain, I don't know, from the 80s onwards, just because she was omnipresent. Kids now, presumably, there's so many other people competing for their attention, but definitely that sort of millennial generation, everyone will have a Delia memory of some sort.
You see, I think most of her... I think she had a lot of anti-inspiration. I think there was a... When she talked about the theatre of the plate and all of that, she was kind of not talking about Cordon Bleu. She was sort of also talking about Fanny Craddock and that really disgusting 70s shit they used to do with food where they'd, like, get a blancmange and turn it into the face of a pig with, like... And it was, like, really, really off-putting.
What? I mean, I like the sound of that. You didn't specify what flavour of blancmange, but I do quite like it. I love it. Anyway, but also Fanny Craddock is a very misunderstood person.
We're going to do an episode of Fanny Craddock, okay, so no, don't worry
about
you'll
get invited on that, and I will. But I think it was it's slightly, you know, that that slight manhandling of food that was very fashionable in the 60s and 70s, she was really against. I think she was quite against the snobbery of Elizabeth David, even though she never said that outright. There was a kind of real trend at the time for like quite posh, experimental, not so much accent on the taste, more accent on the, you know, I've been to Italy and I know what an avocado is, and kind of performative middle classness. And I think she was quite anti that. Even though I kind of see her as tracing through the Jane Grigson tradition, I don't think she is very Jane Grigson. I think she's much more precise than that. As you were saying in your summing up at the start, that she did spend a lot of time in the British Library. And the thing that she reminded me most of is when I was a kid, I used to cook from this cookbook that came with the oven that my grandmother bought in the 40s. And it was like a kind of quite, it was like famously in the 40s, loads of cookbooks came out that were designed to be very laborious so women would stop working in factories and go back to the kitchen. And so all these kind of oven manual cookbooks were very, very techie. They were like, you need 2.5 ounces of this thing, right, or like a little tiny bit of this thing. And it was kind of very precise and kind of, you know, Miss Tiggy Winkle. And I think she reminds me more of that than she reminds me of Grigson, even though both she and Grigson did a huge amount to kind of revivify British culinary traditions.
Mm-hmm. She's just more of a professional in the Mary Berry School and the Marguerite Patton.
There wasn't
a lot of room in those women's magazines or those women's pages of the Mirror or stuff for like flowery descriptions and etc.
Yeah.
Like, the more I think about it, the more I think that Delia is just a really democratic cook that's now moved on to this kind of ultra democratic People's Assembly,
etc.
thing. Mm-hmm. I can almost see her as some sort of like Wat Tyler figure.
Yeah. In terms of who she inspired, I was thinking obviously Dave Myers died recently in the Hairy Bikers. I think they have the same kind of like unpretentious democratic vibe going on.
Did you read the story about how the Hairy Bikers met?
No.
It was such a cute meet. It was unbelievable. So one of them was at the bar and he ordered a curry in a curry pub. And the guy said, well, if you have two curries, you can get two pints for free. And then the other one comes up and goes, I'll take the second curry.
That was it. Love at first sight.
I was hoping that Delia was going to be in there.
Sorry, yeah, no, that's a complete tangent.
That's nice. This whole series is going to feature like people like that, for sure. I mean, and then obviously, yeah, we talked about Jamie, Nigella, blah blah blah. The last question I want to ask, which is going to be the final question in all of these episodes, is just like in summary to both of you, how would you say that she changed the way that we eat in this country, and do you think it's for better or worse?
I think that she improved it 1,000-fold. She just gave everyone or a lot of people a basis on which to sort of build and go on and cook sort of potentially more exciting, exotic things. But you can't do this until you know the basics. Mm. And I think that what she's about. And I don't think she's given enough credit for being probably the most influential British cook of the late 20th century, I would say, if not the whole 20th century. Like, incredible the influence she had.
Mm. Yeah, no, I agree completely with that. And I think the other thing about her is that a lot of cookbook writers, not only do they come with the kind of personal details of their lives, they come with a sort of tacit assumption of what their life is and what your life should be like. So, you know, are you a person who has a lot of dinner parties? Are you a person who is very healthy? Are you a person who's very experimental? Do you travel a lot? Blah, 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 blah. And Delia really isn't like that at all. You know, she can tell you how to cook vol-au-vents for 50 people, and she can also tell you how to cook for two people in a fancy way, but for two people in a completely unfancy way. And so there's a kind of sense with her writing of cookery as part of every single aspect of your life. Every single day you need to eat, you need to cook it, and then you need to eat it. And so she's a much more, I don't know, gestalt, I would say. She's a much more gestalt writer than any other I can think of. What does gestalt mean?
Sorry.
Well, it means the whole self, the whole person, the whole experience, the whole psyche.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, you've been to
Whole Foods.
You've been to gestalt therapy, surely.
Oh, yeah, not for a while.
Well,
though.
You need to do some work on yourself.
I don't hang out with Guardian columnists that often, so these words are... Who am I kidding? So I threw you off there. You were on a roll.
No, that was it. That was my whole point. My gestalt point, if you like.
Yeah. I buy all that. That makes sense to me. Felicity, Zoe, thank you so much. That was super, super interesting.
Thank you for having us and for the kippa pate, which
say,
I really like.
It's delicious. Well,
thank
Everyone
you, Delia, for the
it.
Recipe. Mm. Yeah. I'll post the recipe or link to the recipe in the show notes. And I'll also post links to both your works as well.
Do you think she'll listen?
Probably not.
She does. I do have a contact. I might send it to her.
Awesome.
Once I've listened to it myself to check I haven't incriminated myself.
Okay, if you could say one thing to Delia, if she was listening, if you could say something to her, what would you say?
Oh, I really love her. I mean, she really changed my...
No, you have to say you.
Oh, sorry, Delia, I really love you. You really changed my life. But I said that at the time. Yeah. So it's old
you've
news.
You've already met her, so...
I've met her, but I also wrote about her all the time when I was in my 20s, as a kind of, it was like really... I really had a lot of fun doing that. You could write about anything in the 90s. It didn't matter.
And you still do that now.
Yeah, actually, that's completely true. I did that today.
Felicity, you've met her as well, but what would your message if you could communicate to her? She was listening.
I think I'd say thank you. I mean, she's just brilliant. And yeah, I'd like her to get a bit more appreciation from relative youngsters like me. I say relative, but yeah. Thank you, Delia.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you both. Thank you, Delia. If you're listening, you're a legend. I will start meditating or not meditating at some point, probably when I'm asleep, though. No, I'm kidding. It's a great book. I liked it. Thank you both. Thanks, everyone. See you next time. Listening to the Full English Podcast, produced by me, Lewis Bassett, with mixing and sound design from Forrest DLG. You can follow us at Full ENG Pod. Thanks for listening.